The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I want to talk a little bit this afternoon about raising bodhicitta as we're preparing to start Ango, a three-month intensive, which is a very old, long-standing tradition, both in the Zen tradition and in other forms, back to the Buddha. And the importance of bodhicitta and the importance of this, particularly within the Mahayana tradition, which is where we find it really being brought out in this very particular way. Dogen, in his one of his fascicles, Arousing the Aspiration for Enlightenment, said, "Arousing the aspiration for enlightenment is making a vow to bring all sentient beings to the shore of enlightenment before you bring yourself, and actualizing this vow. Even a humble person who arouses this aspiration is already a guiding teacher of all sentient beings." Bodhicitta is the raising of the Bodhi mind, the mind of enlightenment, the seeks enlightenment, seeks liberation. But in Mahayana Buddhism, it's not, unified, inseparable from the deep vow and desire to be of service to others, to alleviate suffering in this world, for all beings, in whatever ways we can. The ultimate alleviation of suffering is for human beings to realize that suffering has no fixed basis. It has a very real presence in our everyday lives. We feel it, we see it, we agonize over it, we suffer it. But what the Buddha realized is that in the same way that there is no fixed self-nature that causes us to grasp and cling and defend and protect, and that once liberated from that, then we're liberated from all of those unskillful actions, that in the same way, suffering has no self, has no abiding place, which in a way for a bodhisattva is the greatest heartbreak, because we see how unnecessary it is. Not just in a we could do better kind of way, but in a the fundamental nature of things is such that in this world, at the fundamental basis, there is no suffering, and yet we create it. And we export it. So bodhicitta is the seeking mind, it's the aspiring mind. Before we encounter the Dharma, something is stirring. Something inside. We may understand it, we may not. Oftentimes we don't. It's nascent, it's not very developed, it's not very conscious for most of us. It's just an inner disturbance, an inner discontent, something that is not what we sense could be. And then there are outer aspects, things that are going on in our lives that lead us to question, to doubt, to be dissatisfied, to experience pain, to be confused. And we see cycles repeating themselves and repeating themselves. And we're pretty smart. So we figure, okay, I'm not going to do that again, but we repeat ourselves. We make certain changes. Those changes can have small and large impact, but something underneath isn't yet being addressed. And so seeking the Dharma is actually the first conscious step towards the path. It means we're already willing to go beyond what we know, which is not a small thing for creatures of habit, as we are. means we have to be willing to enter into what we don't know. You know, it's been a marvel to me, kind of a beautiful thing over the years to see so many people come into practice who see themselves as being very sort of withdrawn and timid and not courageous and, you know, insecure and not having confidence, and don't recognize the courage it takes to come to a place like this where they don't know anybody and to enter into a whole way of training that is completely new, pretty much from soup to nuts. And so before bodhicitta can arise, we have to encounter the Dharma. Bodhicitta happens in response to encountering the Dharma, reflecting on it, practicing it. There has to be affinity. That mysterious something. We feel it with people, we feel it with places, we feel it with the Dharma. I remember the first time I encountered the Dharma, back in the 70s, the first teachings I ever encountered. Actually, the first teachings was a Lotus Sutra, which made no sense to me at all. And so I just sort of disregarded that. But then I encountered a book on Zen, and I encountered these teachings, and I realized there's something true about this. I can't tell you why. I couldn't defend it. But I knew. For me, I thought I knew this was true. So there has to be affinity. And then we have to be willing to actually take it up. And for most of us, this is a step-by-step process. Nobody comes into practice trusting completely. I mean, what does that even mean? Everybody comes into practice generally as more or less an adult, and which means we've experienced things in our lives that were painful. We've been hurt. And we naturally protect ourselves. And in that protection, trust retreats, right? We learn not to trust too easily. And so that has to be awakened and made smart, right? We have to really understand, what does that mean to trust deeply? And then very quickly, usually the first time we arrive here, we encounter the Bodhisattva vow. I remember the first time I encountered that on a Sunday morning program at the end of the discourse, and chanting those words and not even thinking, I don't know what this means. It wasn't even that close yet. If we really took in the significance, the meaning of what those words are saying, what these vows are presenting, it's the expression, the embodiment of bodhicitta. We encounter it at the very beginning, and that's important because it's like we have to begin to take it in. We have to begin to imagine that there could be such a life, such a way of being, that someone could live such a life. Maybe not yet ourselves, but someone. We see glimpses of it, moments when we see other people manifesting Buddhist, not Buddhist, manifesting that kind of selflessness, putting others before themselves. But to really take that in as a vow that I will make and base my life in, it's not a small thing. So in encountering that, which is why I think it's so important that we encounter it at the very beginning, and of course when we first are chanting it, we're not taking those vows. We're just chanting those teachings, chanting those vows, but we're not yet having formally taken them. Of course, you, each and any individual, could feel such an affinity and want to take them on as one's own, and then you're invited to do that. (Laughs) But in encountering those, it then helps to put into relief everything that's not that, right? The ways in which we put ourselves before others, the ways in which we are not concerned about suffering of others, the ways that we're not concerned about our attachments, or we indulge them, the way we are not yet courageous enough or feel secure enough or that we are of the stuff to actually study this Dharma in a very deep and profound way. Dogen said, this aspiration is neither originally existed nor does it emerge all of a sudden. It's neither one nor many. It's neither spontaneous nor formed gradually. This aspiration is not in yourself, nor are you in it. It's interesting. This language is very much similar to how the Buddha spoke of the self as being perceived as the skandhas. That the skandhas are in the self is in the skandhas. And Dogen is saying, with regards to bodhicitta, there is no fixed form. It has no self. It is not a thing. And we should always remember that when we're talking about things, that there is no thing where that place abides. We can see that very clearly with bodhicitta. I mean, is it in your body? Is it in your mind? Does it live within a particular part of your body? Can it be held? Can it be measured? It's not something you have or don't have. It's not something you can get or lose. Can't be given to you. It has no location or fixed quality. It's a living thing. That's what makes it so powerful. It's a living thing. That's what makes everything so powerful. That everything is a living thing. That's why that's why the Bodhisattva vow is so important, to recognize that everything is a living thing. And to care about it deeply, to want to alleviate suffering, means we have to be very attentive. Because we're always in the midst of living things. And everything we do has consequence. Dogen says, in response to affinity between the teacher and the teachings and the student, the aspiration for enlightenment arises. It's not given by Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. You don't create it yourself. The aspiration arises in response to affinity. It is not spontaneous. And I think that's such a delicious and important point about this Dharma, is what is affinity? What does that mean? Right? If you know that this is your path, how do you know that? How did you come to know that? At what moment or in what moments did that become clear to you? And in those moments, was there something that we could call affinity? It's not an idea. It's not an abstract thing. It's not theoretical. It's something that you feel. Stand back. Think about it. It doesn't really make sense. But it's undeniable. And isn't that perhaps what really allows us to trust and to enter and to engage when, in a sense, we have no right to do so yet? Right? I mean, we have no basis for throwing ourselves into something, not knowing what happens next, not knowing where it goes. This is the nature of all vows. You know, you got to just leap, and then you'll find out. And so for most, it occurs over time, practicing, evolving, an endless stream of experiences. And we see all the ways in which our self, our history, our attachments, our ways obstruct, make things harder. And that's why metta practices are so important. You know, the Four Measurables, the Sutra of Great Compassion, sending and receiving, doing your own liturgy in which you invoke compassion and you extend it to others. Those practices are so important because they're a way to embody again, in incipient ways in the beginning, very, very small, very timid in the beginning sometimes, but in ways that are making it very clear through language, through intention, through affinity, that you have an intention which is larger. It's larger. And so one of those practices is the four reminders to reflect on this precious human life, you know, which we so often take for granted. It's one of the nice things about getting sick, you know. Right? You realize, you know, one day you're feeling great, the next day you don't feel so great. Things that were so easy, you know, you toss them off like nothing the day before, and today you can't even kind of get yourself to do them. Right? How fragile we are. How we live within this narrow band. Right? This narrow band. Just like our earth lives within this narrow band that we're, you know, pretty clearly screwing up in a big way. That allows human life to be possible. That allows human vitality and vibrancy to be possible. And when that wanders off into the margins, we experience it in no uncertain terms. It reminds us, oh, this is fragile. This human life is precious. Right? Not just because I get to be alive from the Bodhisattva perspective, it's because I can do something with this life. I can try in all the ways that I can to be useful, to be of benefit, in real ways, to put others before myself. And so to reflect on that and really bring that in deeply, right? And to reflect, part of that can be reflecting and needs to be reflecting on impermanence and death, which in a sense not only tempers the celebration of this precious human life, but actually helps to strengthen it because we realize, oh, this actually doesn't last that long. Not really. And so we might contemplate ourselves sick, infirmed. We might meditate on ourselves in our deathbed, dying, dead, corpse, lifeless. To bring that in, to make it more real in our mind, not something we would typically do. Just face that reality. And now that precious human birth is even more important. And we realize everyone is in that. Everyone has that precious human birth. Everyone is in the midst of impermanence and death. And then to reflect on the on samsara, the unsatisfying nature of samsara. The reason, you know, I think in a big way, the practice is so difficult in the beginning. And by beginning, I mean years. Depends on how things evolve. Is because samsara, you know, it's a clever arrangement. It does actually give us a lot of things that we want, a lot of things that we think we need. And so it's difficult to turn, to consciously let go, not indulge, not go there in our minds, not go there in our bodies. Right? And so we have to have faith, we have to listen to the teachings and hear what these teachers have said about all of the, you know, the dangers of turning towards samsara over and over again. But eventually what happens is, it's not just that we get better at letting go. We get better at sort of relinquishing or renouncing. There's a point at which renouncing is not really so important, no, so necessary, because we're not really that hungry for samsara anymore. And that doesn't mean we lose our taste for a finely cooked meal or for an evening with friends or for being in love, any of those things. Course. Those things are in a way even more beautiful because we understand that they're fleeting. We understand what they can bring to our lives and what they can't. So we don't sort of mess it up by expecting more. And so it gets easier to not only let go, but really just not turn in that direction. And then from within that, really the only sensible thing to do is turn towards the path. Because if we're not turning towards all those old ways, then where do we stand? What are we doing? Shanti Deva said, thus, upon firmly adopting the spirit of awakening, bodhicitta, a student of the Dharma should always vigilantly strive not to neglect your training. Although you have made a commitment, it might be appropriate to reconsider whether this has been done rashly and not been well considered. You know, this passage takes place within the midst of this incredible text that is, one teacher I was reading, an old teacher, ancient teacher, was talking about it. It wasn't ancient, it was actually, it couldn't have been, because he referred to it as kind of puritanical. But it's very insistent. It's very demanding. And it's very sort of, not really speaking to the choir so much, but presuming that, you know, there is an affinity. And here, in the midst of all of that, it's like, stop for a moment. Sit down. Consider. Have you undertaken this rashly? Have you considered this? The answer probably is no. We haven't really. In a sense, we can only reflect on it or consider it to the degree that we understand it. And that's in a constant state of development. And that's just the way it works. Maybe that's the best thing. I mean, if we fully understood all the implications, would any of us be here? Maybe a courageous few. In the Sarangama Sutra, it says, examine the resolve that is the basis of your practice that leads to enlightenment. Examine your intention, your aspiration, that is the basis for your practice. And then it says, is this resolve identical to the awakening that will be the result of your practice, or is it not? In other words, is our aspiration in alignment with the path, with the way, with the Dharma, with what this actually is? You know, that's part of what's happening. I mean, that's happening, should be happening all the time. That's why it's so important to continually be studying the Dharma and bringing that into reflection in terms of our own practice. It's also such an important part of the face-to-face teaching that the teacher is trying to ensure that the student is staying true to the Dharma. And sometimes the teacher may see that the student is not, that they're going off into areas, into directions that are not really in accord with the Dharma, and the teacher may feel like they're not really going to be that helpful for them and can guide them back. And sometimes they can't because the student won't, they don't want to give that up. Dogen says, the meaning of the aspiration for enlightenment is to endeavor without ceasing in body, speech, and mind to help all sentient beings to arouse the aspiration of enlightenment. This leads them into the Buddha way, to provide sentient beings merely with worldly pleasures, not ultimately beneficial to them. It can be temporarily beneficial. That's why dana is the first paramita and is very, very important as a practice, but ultimately, the meaning of aspiration is to endeavor to help all sentient beings to arouse the aspiration of enlightenment. And to think about, what does that mean? People who are Buddhist, people who are non-Buddhist. And most of us are not teachers, so we're not in that role in relationship with people. And even if we are, as I just mentioned, we only have a limited amount of power. The real power is in the hands of the student and of the individual. They're the ones making the choices. But to think of how can we help to arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, to arouse a seeking mind, to bring forth a sense of an appreciation for this precious human life, to bring forth an awareness in someone about impermanence and death, of the dissatisfying nature of samsara. All of these are ways, in simple ways, that we can, when given opportunities, and if skillful, can in a small way take a step to arouse that aspiration for enlightenment, for something more. And so bodhicitta is spoken of in terms of giving rise to the aspiration. So each day when you, if you wake up and you do liturgy or you just bring forth an intention as you begin your day, of how you want, what you want to bring forth, of how you want to be in this world, of what you want to be generating. And you hold that in your mind, and you hold it as a heartfelt wish, and you give it language and words, and you mean it. That's helping to arouse your aspiration. And then there's living bodhicitta, which is having aroused that aspiration, now you leap into your life. You leap into the day. And rather than just leaping forward with all the things on our list or all the things we have to do, it's really looking at that list, looking at all the unexpected things that will happen, the chance encounters, and thinking, how could I bring something? How could I bring something? And just how we encounter people, that we actually encounter them, we see them, we acknowledge them, we offer a word, simple, simple, simple. We should never underestimate the power of simple actions. And all of this is working towards opening up that bodhisattva heart that is begins to more and more be concerned with others. And as we practice, remember, this is not all happening in isolation by any means. We're practicing the Eightfold Path, we're practicing the precepts, we're doing Zazen, we're doing all the things that practice is, which means we're practicing developing mindfulness, developing our concentration, we're practicing letting go of our attachments, letting go of self-clinging. And in that, as we're simultaneously practicing through meta-practices, through the way we live each day, through our aspirations, our liturgy, we are giving rise to, we're strengthening our compassion. And so bodhicitta, you know, from the point of view of the Dharma, is when it really becomes putting ourselves before others. And there's a passage in Shantideva's Guide to a Bodhisattva Way of Life where he's talking about how, you know, all the great bodhisattvas of the past, they would lay down their lives, you know, in the Jataka tales, the Buddha would, you know, there was a hungry tigress who had to feed her cubs. She was dying of hunger, so the pre-Buddha gave his flesh, right, so the tigress could eat him and then feed her cubs. And Shantideva goes through all of these passages about this, and he said, you may not be ready for this. It's sort of like, don't do this at home, kids. So then, but the question is, well, what are we ready for? And so we study ourselves, we study others, we study events, we study conversations, and I don't mean in a heavy-handed way. I mean just awake, alert, aware, wanting to see things more clearly, wanting to live more harmoniously, wanting to be alive. We learn from moments of withdrawal and fear and hesitation and aggression. They have much to teach. We learn from moments where we are consciously and deliberately practicing compassion with perhaps some effort, because there is much to learn there. And then there are moments that are not created by yourself, when this aspiration is not in yourself, nor are you in it. There is someone who reaches out, but it's not you. In the Surangama Sutra, it says, based on false views and our attachments, the consciousnesses that are connected to each of our senses and their objects are no longer in their correct relationship. I thought that's a very nice way of putting it. That when we're confused and, you know, tangled up in things, our consciousness and the things that we experience are no longer in their correct relationship. And with this entanglement, the sutra says, there is turbidity, cloudiness. And it really makes sense in terms of how we then try and go about correcting that, right? Correct the relationship, which very often becomes correcting you, right? If I perceive that we do not have a correct relationship, then I might very quickly come to the assumption that if only you would do such and such and such, then we would have a correct relationship. And so we turn the light back. The analogy of sand being thrown into a container of water has been used for hundreds and hundreds of years. So if you think of that, if you have a container of water and you throw sand into it, then it, you know, it fills all the water and it's cloudy and you can't see its clarity. The water is by nature clear, but it's hard to see that. But if you allow the container to be undisturbed, then the sand will naturally settle, right? And the water regains its natural clarity. Very nice. Until the container moves. And then the sand stirs up again. And so this is why practicing just calming the mind, just calming the kleshas, just letting go of all of our sort of, you know, negative tendencies alone is not enough. Because the seeds for all of that is the sand that always resides, in a sense, in the bottom of the container. And so when we realize, finally, that that sand is empty of self-nature, it doesn't actually cloud anything. It's the mind that perceives not being in a correct relationship, that sees the sand as obstructing the water. A Chinese master said, for this reason, using that analogy, be completely unmoving in your meditation. Don't move and shift at the first sight of pain or restlessness. One who is still and unmoving learns to be unafraid. I thought that was very interesting. One who is still and unmoving learns to be unafraid. Why? Because we have to sit and meet in peacefulness, in non-aggression, everything that would cause us to move and be afraid. And so we develop, not just stamina and resilience, but we develop, and not just courage, but we develop an understanding that whatever this is does not have its own power. One who is still and unmoving learns to be unafraid. With the settling of sand, delusion, and afflictions, your true nature, water, appears, is seen. But if you simply let the sand stay on the bottom, as soon as the container is moved, the sand is stirred again. And thus we have to go further. And so relative bodhicitta is spoken of as what we practice every day, bringing it into our consciousness, returning to our practice when we forget, letting it evolve, doing those metta practices. Ultimate bodhicitta is realizing that all phenomena is a dream. That every desire, every thought, every intention, every aspiration, every action, every consequence has no abiding place, is not a thing. It all appears and disappears moment after moment. We can sustain them in our mind through clinging. We call that attachment, and that's our delusion. We can also sustain them in our mind through mindfulness. Interesting. And a rightly intended coming forth of thoughts, words, and actions. In other words, we sustain what is helpful to sustain. We don't perpetuate what is not helpful to perpetuate. So when you see yourself hearing something, hearing some bad news, or, you know, encountering something that raises, brings forth a reaction, and then you see your mind beginning to turn and turn and turn and create worlds and worlds, that is not a helpful sustaining of thought. Dogen said in that same fascicle, he quotes the Buddha, who said, "What is the one thing that bodhisattvas guard? It is the aspiration for enlightenment. Bodhisattvas, great beings, always endeavor to guard this aspiration for enlightenment, just as people in the world protect their only child." It's like a one-eyed person protecting their one working eye, or people traveling in a vast wilderness protecting their guide. Bodhisattvas guard the aspiration for enlightenment in this way. Because bodhisattvas guard the aspiration for enlightenment, they attain unsurpassable complete enlightenment. Because they attain unsurpassable complete enlightenment, they embody consistency, enjoyment, freedom, and purity. Thus, bodhisattvas guard this one thing. And of course, what he's saying is we guard it because we can lose it. We can lose our awareness of, the affinity with, the immediacy of, the power of, because it's not a thing, right? It's not a thing you get and you just park it in your house or your room so it's always there, or you put it on a leash so it always comes behind you, or you put it in your pocket, right? Of course, that's absurd. It's not a thing. And so it can come and go in our mind. And so to practice this path means we have to become reasonably proficient at recognizing when we're losing it, when it's being forgotten, when it's becoming distant, and then how to remember. And there's a great deal of guidance and support from the Dharma in that, because you're not the first one. And one of the things that really becomes so important is we realize, particularly as practice continues and is developing and, you know, we're seeing changes in our life, it's very easy to get to a point where it's like, you know, this is pretty good. Like, you know, I've come a long way, or, you know, yeah, I should come back to this, but I'll get to it later. You know, or things aren't so bad. When it's just for us, right, it's much easier to be like that. But when others are depending on us, when we really have dedicated ourselves to others, it's different. It's different. In a vast way. Parents, I'm sure, know this. Anyone who cares deeply about one thing, one living thing, knows this. If that caring translates into wanting to protect that, wanting to guard that. And so we have, well, I often think of, you know, we just have these two little puppies outside in the front of the main front door, right? But don't underestimate them. They're, don't mess with them, because they will bite you. But in traditional monasteries, they're huge. They're fearsome, right? You definitely don't want to mess with them. And they're guardians at the gate of the monastery. And in fact, at the gate of Ahiji, I don't remember exactly what it says, but there are several plaques that Dogen, I think, was responsible for. And it's basically, as I recall, both saying how incredible and wonderful it is that you have arrived at this gate, and also, watch out. As the passage of the Buddha that Dogen is quoting says, "As there are many who turn away and lose their aspiration, you should always be careful not to lose yours. For this reason, guard your aspiration for enlightenment." Often the reason beginning bodhisattvas lose their aspiration is that they haven't met authentic teachers. And if they don't meet an authentic teacher, then they don't listen to the true Dharma. And if they don't listen to the true Dharma, then they deny cause and effect. They deny emancipation. They deny the three treasures. They deny all things in the present and future. Then they are wastefully attached to the five desires of the present moment and lose the possibility of enlightenment in the future. And so he's basically, you know, saying how important it is to meet teachers, a teaching. But, you know, a teaching as alive and powerful as it is and how absolutely necessary they are, I mean, that goes without saying. And how I think we can get to the point where the teaching, a teaching becomes a teacher in the sense of a living thing that is holding us, that is meeting us face to face, that is holding us accountable. But that comes from us. But study with a teacher, that's why in the Buddhist tradition, particularly in the Mahayana, our living teachers are not considered more important than the Buddha, but our living teachers are the ones that are here. Dada Roshi was the one who put his ass in that Dokusan room year after year after year after year. Year after year. And came in here and gave talks year after year after year and took care of this place and us. And because it's a living thing, when we study with a teacher, it's always changing. As we change, it changes. As we change, in a sense, the teacher changes. And we then have the opportunity to encounter the Dharma. I remember asking Dada Roshi many years ago when we had a senior student who decided to leave and study elsewhere. And I said, why does it always happen that when a student gets to a certain point and they gain confidence and sort of they become more self-assured, that they all leave? We all leave. You know, we get to the point where we think, okay, you know, I've pretty much done this. And my teacher says, no, there's a lot further to go. And I'm like, really? I don't know. And I said, why doesn't everybody leave? And he said, it's part of the teacher's job is to keep showing them what is still lies ahead, and to make it real for them. That there's more, and there's more that you do not want to miss. There's more that your life depends on. That if you think this has opened up your door, just wait. Which is another way of saying we need continually to be inspired. And, importantly, we need to be able to practice when we are not inspired, right? Because you're not a machine, I'm not a machine. And so sometimes you are doing these practices, you are engaging, you're doing all you can to bring it forth, and you just feel a little dull. That's not the first time. And to be able to just take that in stride and say, okay, how do I practice wholeheartedly with this dullness? It's really an extraordinary thing. Because then you don't have to be afraid of that anymore. Watchful, but not afraid. The Buddha in this quote says, in order to distract a practicing bodhisattva, Mara, or someone like Mara, disguises as the Buddha or a parent or a teacher, relative, and approaches the bodhisattva and makes up a statement like, the Buddha way is long and far away and painful. It's most troubling. It's best to come free from birth and death first, and then bring other sentient beings across. In other words, take care of yourself, free yourself, and then you can deal with others. Or maybe just the Buddha way is long, far away, and painful. It's really troubling. What the hell are you doing? Right? Why are you bothering? There's a whole bunch of fun going on out there. Hearing these words, practitioners turn away from their aspiration for enlightenment and their bodhisattva practice. But the wonderful thing is that even in our turning away, you know, we can turn away from the Dharma for a moment, a year, 10 years, 20 years. I mean, I see it all the time. But in the moment you turn back, guess what? Guess what's waiting for you? Guess what's never been anywhere else? Shantideva said, this intention, this great aspiration, which is an ocean of great good, vast and boundless, it seeks to place all beings in a state of bliss and joy, and every action for the benefit of all. This is my delight. This is my joy. This is what gives my life vitality and joy. It is the universal vehicle that saves this bodhisattva path. Universal because it is applied equally to everyone. It leaves no one out. All wandering beings from the state of loss that tries in whatever way possible to arouse a question, a doubt, to satisfy a need in this moment, which maybe instills a bit more trust or creates a little bit more stability so that the person can then take another step. This rising moon of the enlightened mind that soothes the sorrow born of the afflictions, what a beautiful image. This rising mind, moon of the enlightened mind. And then Shantideva calls out, living beings, wayfarers upon life's path, you who wish to taste the riches of contentment, here before you is your supreme bliss. Here, O ceaseless wanderers, is your fulfillment. Don't turn away. Don't go seeking elsewhere. Don't doubt yourself. Here you are. And so, within the sight of all protectors, I summon every being, calling him to Buddhahood. Until that state is reached, to every earthly joy, may gods and demigods and all beings rejoice. In other words, until we all cross over, may all beings be at ease. So I am going to retreat back into my little den of getting over feeling poorly, which I'm well on my way, but I, again, don't want to get anybody sick. And I think by tomorrow, I should be pretty much ready for it. I will definitely be here for the Ango entering. There is a special place in hell for rabbits who miss that. And so, whatever the odds, I will be here. Okay, so please, on this short day, you know, the beautiful thing about a weekend session is, you know, accustomed to week-long sessions is we think, okay, I've got the week ahead of me, and it's like, okay, the first day is just going to be like sort of a, you know, work through all the slog, through all the stuff, and then the second day, and we sort of map it out. You don't have this on just a weekend session. You got to, like, land. And that's really good, to see how in our minds we create, you know, space in ways that isn't helpful, right? Perspectives that are not always true. You know, when you just have this amount of time to use this amount of time, well, and so please do that. And I will see you in the morning. Okay.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.